In his new book, The Brain's Way of Healing, Remarkable Discoveries and Recoveries from the Frontiers of Neuroplasticity, bestselling author Norman Doidge shows for the first time how the amazing process of neuroplastic healing really works and helps patients suffering from MS, Parkinson's, epilepsy, cerebral palsy, autism, ADD, ADHD, dementia, and other neurological diseases. Again, the name of the book is The Brain's Way of Healing, Remarkable Discoveries and Recoveries, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Norman Doidge to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me.
You are a psychiatrist, a psychoanalyst, and analyst. And I'm interested in what brought you to this idea of healing and ultimately what is possible within the brain to heal.
Well, doctors are supposed to be interested in healing, of course, so I was drawn to that, as anyone in a helping profession
right.
of that sort is. The model of the brain for really about 100 years or more has been that you don't use the word healing and the brain in the same sentence. The brain, it was thought, just didn't heal the way other organs like the liver or the gastrointestinal tract or the skin or the bones could heal. It was thought that it, in the course of evolution, had become just way too sophisticated and complicated to a price had to be paid for all of its complexity, and that was it couldn't heal. So I was drawn to it in stages. So the first was when I went to medical school, until really quite recently, most people were taught that the brain was very much like a machine with parts, and each part performed a single mental function in a single location in the brain. If that was damaged, there was nothing much that could be done about that. You'd have to learn to work around the problem. Machines don't grow new parts. It was thought that the circuits of the brain were hardwired and they couldn't be altered after childhood. And then I started to see evidence coming out of neuroscience labs that activity in animals and ultimately in human beings led to changes in brain structure. And I trained at Columbia University, where Eric Kandel was a major figure, and he won the Nobel Prize in the year 2000 for medicine or physiology, showing that as animals learn, they change the number of connections between neurons, cells of the nervous system. So what I did is I started to investigate if this was clinically relevant, as I suspected it would be, and that led to a first book on brain plasticity, and now this one on healing of the brain. And Why am I drawn? I'm drawn because I see some conditions which we thought couldn't be helped can be helped. I just want to say that I'm not claiming that dementia can be cured, but we could get into this later on. There's very strong evidence that the risk of dementia can be decreased by 60% if you do certain things. So that's how I got into it.
You talked about this in the last book, and you make the point here that when it comes to neuroplasticity, that this is really the most important development in our understanding of the brain in more than 400 years. So the question is, why did it take us so long to come to this understanding?
That's a very good question. If the brain is plastic, why didn't we notice it? I say it's the most important change in our understanding of the relationship between the mind and the brain in 400 years, because we thought that, you know, basically the mind, particularly in the last 100 years, that, you know, the mind is what the brain does. That, you know, changes in the brain lead to changes in the structure of our thoughts. You know, you can't do higher math if a certain part of the brain is blanked out by, you know, a stroke. Now we discover that mental activity, mind, can actually change brain structure. You had to be able to make microscopic movies of the brain to demonstrate that the brain was plastic. So that's the first reason. The second reason was sometimes there was evidence of brain plasticity, but people just wrote it off. They said, so if a person ever, you know, had a stroke and got better 3 years later by doing lots and lots of, you know, kinds of rehab, much more than was recommended, which was usually 6 weeks. This model of the brain is like a machine with fixed parts was so powerful that the doctors and would say, well, obviously you didn't really have a serious stroke or we got the diagnosis wrong. Then the other reason we didn't see it is because sometimes brain plasticity can give rise to rigid behavior. Whenever you train to do something and you do it over and over again, the cells in the brain that are involved in that start to fire stronger, clearer signals, and they get very, very good at doing it, and that's how you form habits. And sometimes it becomes hard to break. So plasticity is like snow on a hill in winter. You know, if you go down that hill, the snow is modifiable. It's a metaphor for plasticity. And you can take many different paths down that hill initially because it's so flexible. But if you had a good run the first time, you'll probably do a similar run the second and third and fourth times. And you start to build tracks in that snow. And you it becomes rigid. It's hard to get out of those tracks. And the same thing goes for plasticity. Often we would look at people, they'd be doing the same thing over and over, and we tried to get them to change and they wouldn't. And so we projected back onto their brain that if their behaviors are rigid, well, their brains must be rigid. So plasticity gives rise both to rigid and flexible behaviors depending on how you use it. And that masked the existence of the plasticity in the brain for scientists and for individuals alike.
So talk a little bit about the non-invasive procedures that are used to treat the brain and how ultimately they are beneficial.
Okay. So first I have to tell you how they work. I describe many avenues into the brain that don't involve cracking open a skull.
Right.
But can influence and help people rewire brains in, you know, pretty significant neurological conditions. So to understand how they work, I just got to explain a thing about brain damage and then a thing about how the brain works, and then it'll make sense. In general, when a person has brain damage or a brain disease, there's just this tendency to look at the level of lost function, like they're paralyzed, and assume if they're paralyzed, well, their whole motor cortex, the part of the brain that processes movement, must be wiped out. That's just something we've kind of done. We've looked at their function and projected it back into the brain. But it turns out that that's often not the case. Here's what's happening in the brain, as far as I understand it, putting together lots and lots of scientific studies. When there's damage or disease, there are some neurons that die, and they produce no signals whatsoever. There are neurons adjacent to them that were accustomed to getting the signals of those dead neurons that are suddenly kind of in a withdrawal state, to be metaphorical. They're just not getting any signals, and it's like they don't know what to do for a bit. There are sick neurons beside them, and they're firing at unusual rates in the brain that don't make any sense, sort of like a heart that's in a dysrhythmia or an arrhythmia. They're firing often too slowly. They produce things called delta waves. But they're not of much use. And then there are all the neurons that are getting these bad signals from the other neurons. And so they have junk information in and junk information out. They're healthy neurons, but they're getting bad signals. So there's not necessarily nearly as much cell death as we thought. And over time, because there's a lot of what I call noise in the brain. I call it the noisy brain, which exists in many, many neurological conditions. The circuits start to fade away because it's a use-it-or-lose-it brain. That's another core law of plasticity. Now, the lingua franca of the brain, the universal language of the brain, is the firing of electrical signals or patterns of energy. And not only does the brain fire these patterns of energy, but it's seamlessly connected to our senses, our sense receptors, which receive patterns of different kinds of energy from the outside world. So, for instance, sound waves come to the cochlea, which is part of the inner ear, and the patterns of energy in the sound waves, which contain information, is converted by this sensory receptor into electrical patterns of information. And we know that if you start, for instance, if someone in a Camaro car pulls up beside you with the window rolled down, playing a very, very loud music with a strong bass beat, that your neurons will actually start firing in synchrony with that beat. That's how seamlessly the outside world energy patterns are translated into the neurons. And if they keep firing, they'll change the structure of those neurons. So we can use this with vision, with vibration, with sound, even with movement, to reshape the brain. And the brain's way of healing shows how a lot of those conditions you said, you described at the beginning of your show, Parkinson's, MS, traumatic brain injury, autism, learning disorders, chronic pain problems, can now be helped using these non-invasive techniques, which have, you know, they're not drugs or surgery, so they don't have side effects, or they're exceedingly, exceedingly rare, and gentle. And, you know, we could just talk about some of the stories that interest you if you want, but that's basically the scheme as to how it works.
I'm curious as to, as I mentioned, the subtitle of the book is Remarkable Discoveries and Recoveries from the Frontiers of Neuroplasticity. So what are the, do we know what the possibilities are yet, or are we just scratching the surface on this?
You know, that's hard to tell. I think that the answer is we don't know the full extent of what the possibilities are. You think of, I don't know, Michael Faraday, who in the 1800s is discovering the relationship between electricity and magnetism. And here we are 150-ish years later. And there's still extraordinary inventions coming up every day involving electricity and computers, et cetera. You know, these things, many of them grow out of his first findings. Plasticity is that property of the brain that allows it to change its structure and function in response to mental experience. This is big, the fact that the mind can change brain structure. We don't know how much brain structure it can and can't change. I'm not saying it's infinite. I'm not saying we can change everything. We just don't know yet. But in this book, you know, I'm dealing with some pretty significant neurological and psychiatric conditions that till recently, you know, take something like autism. Most parents, even today, when their children are found out to be autistic, are told it's overwhelmingly genetic and there's really nothing much major they can do about it. You can try to train them to act courteously and so on and so forth. But I think that this is just mistaken. That, you know, the studies of genes have shown two things. The first thing is that genetics pose a risk for autism, but environmental factors are essential in the overwhelming majority of cases to trigger these risks. And so it's not simply genetic in the overwhelming majority of cases, and even in the cases where the genes have been shown to be most strongly correlated with autism, it's possible to have those genes and not have autism. So the model is changing. The second thing we've learned from genetics is this whole new field of epigenetics and basically how environmental activities, and I put the neuroplastic activities among them, can alter the expressions of our genes. And and that's how plasticity works. It's environmental experiences turn certain genes on to change the circuitry. And so I think it's just opening huge doors. We don't know how far they would go. You know, people always go to the hardest problems first. So they talk about Alzheimer's and say, well, does plasticity affect Alzheimer's? I would say, number one, it changes our understanding of Alzheimer's to some degree because the Alzheimer's brain is a brain that's actually lost its plasticity globally. That's a new way of looking at it. And while there is no cure that I know of for Alzheimer's, if you look at the dementias in general, and Alzheimer's is, you know, perhaps the most important of the dementias, but there are many dementias, you can lower the risk of those by a number of activities, by a staggering 60%. And the most powerful intervention works neuroplastically. And these are just everyday, regular behaviors that anyone could engage in.
Dr. Norman Doidge is the author of the new book, The Brain's Way of Healing. He is also on the research faculty at Columbia University Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research in New York City and on the faculty of the University of Toronto's Department of Psychiatry. Again, the name of the book is The Brain's Way of Healing. It is published by Viking. Dr. Norman Doidge, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
A great pleasure. Thank you again. The title of the book is The Brain's Way of Healing, Remarkable Discoveries and Recoveries from the Frontiers of Neuroplasticity. Dr. Norman Doidge is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.